of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass
These
descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Tuesday, May 5th, 2009, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think.
Silence is not an option.
A special on the Afghanistan war with Christian Parenti, Samir Dosani, and Ann Jones. And a conversation with Afghanistan vet Rick Reyes, plus a look at the controversial acquittal of four white teens who beat an immigrant to death, and Empire Notes.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. President Barack Obama will meet tomorrow with the presidents of Pakistan and Afghanistan in a high-level summit in Washington, D.C. to discuss the new U.S. strategy in South and Central Asia. Both Presidents Asif Ali Zardari of Pakistan and Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan are rapidly losing the support of their constituents as the Obama administration vows to refocus the so-called war on terror in their countries. Karzai faces re-election this summer and just announced his running mate, the notorious warlord and current defense minister, Mohammad Qasim Fahim, widely known for running a private armed militia and offering protection to criminal gangs and drug runners. In Pakistan, the government's Inter-Services Intelligence Agency is known for providing strategic and weapons support to the Taliban in their growing insurgency against the U.S.-NATO occupation. The challenges are immense, but many critics contend that they do not require a military solution and that sending more troops will only worsen the problem. Last week, I attended a one-day conference in New York organized by the Afghanistan Peace Association, bringing together prominent Afghan Americans and progressive non-Afghans to discuss peace and development in Afghanistan. I played excerpts from interviews with two Afghan Americans on Friday. While I was at the conference, I also spoke with Christian Parenti, Ann Jones, and Samir Dosani, who are panelists there, and today I'll play excerpts from those interviews. We'll start with Christian Parenti, who's a correspondent for The Nation magazine and author of the book The Freedom, Shadows and Hallucinations in Occupied Iraq. I began by asking Christian why he thought President Obama is expanding the war in Afghanistan and into Pakistan.
I think that the primary purpose of that conflict for the Obama administration is as theater to be properly managed or to appear to be properly managed so that the Obama administration can be reelected in 4 years. That is the primary objective. Secondary objectives, they would like things to get more stable. They would like to see some development happen. But they don't, I think, fundamentally think that Afghanistan can be transformed or Pakistan. And I think, I mean, in terms of Pakistan, they probably have, you know, they're probably developing a strategy. So, I mean, the question of their relationship to the Pakistani state is, you know, I think evolving. And I don't know as much about that but as I do about the in Afghanistan. So I think that's the primary thing, is that they want it to look like they're making progress so they can win. In terms of what do I think of it, I mean, it's inadequate. You know, to have a one-day conference where you pull everybody together, I mean, that is totally inadequate in terms of dealing with the interests of states in the region that have concerns. I mean, there's a huge Air Force base, Shindad, on the border with Iran, which is potentially to be incorporated into an anti-missile system that surrounds Iran and is in the eyes of Iran and the eyes of many people quite reasonably about, you know, Iran's face-off with Israel, you know, and so Iran feels threatened by the U.S. occupation in Afghanistan. I mean, that's not going to be dealt with in a one-day conference. The reason that Pakistan has for years run essentially mercenaries into Afghanistan is intimately linked to Pakistan's legitimate security concerns with India. That's not something that was, I think, even on the, you know, the table in any way in this little one-day conference that they had. So I don't see the Obama administration as dealing realistically and seriously with the situation. And if they were to do that, I think the center of it would be a grand bargain in which the entire region, from Palestine, Israel, through to the Pakistan-India conflict, were on the table. And in that conference, the U.S. would have to play a central role, but it would have to accept that it was not dictating terms to other countries. And there would have to be a real give and take where different parties would exchange things between each other, that India would guarantee Pakistan security. Pakistan would in turn agree not to fund fundamentalists in India to destabilize India. Afghanistan and Pakistan likewise would have to come to agreements. I mean, Afghanistan would have to accept the Durand Line. I mean, you know, there's infinite details. But if that's not at the center of it, then 30,000 more troops, some more money, some less money, I don't think it's going to work. And I think they know it's not going to work. And I think what they really want to do is make it look like it's going to work so they can get reelected in 4 years. That's the key thing for them.
Christian Parenti is a correspondent for The Nation magazine. Also at the conference was Anne Jones, a photographer and human rights activist and author of Kabul in Winter.
I want to start with this so-called Afghan family law, or some people call it the rape law. What do you think that represents for Afghanistan? Is it sort of a dramatic change in women's rights, or is it the end point of a gradual shift over the past 8 years?
No, I think it's it sends a signal about the where the government stands, because we've gone along all this time supposedly saying there's some gradual change in women's lives and women's rights, most of which is just imagination. There hasn't been that much change. But it left the donor nations and Afghans themselves with the notion that what applies in this country was the Constitution, and that, I mean, now we have women in Parliament. Women do have the opportunity, in theory at least, to get somewhere. This law, for the first time, codifies rules that are contrary to every international human rights treaty that Afghanistan is a signatory to, such as the Convention to Eliminate All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. And it also contravenes the Afghan Constitution. So to blithely go ahead and write that into law is just astonishing, because what it says is that all this other stuff, all the paper rights that have been awarded to women by signing these treaties and by drawing up this constitution, are just window dressing. And this is how we really feel about women. This is what we think women's position really should be, and that's going to be the law. So it's totally outrageous.
Can you expand on something you touched upon quite a bit on your panel, which was we tend to talk about women's rights in Afghanistan in a separate category, and that every time people do mention it, it's as though it's separate from human rights?
Yes, we talk about it as a special category, and when we do that, then we can detach it. Everybody can agree, oh, yes, women's rights are very important, but right now we have to deal with the Taliban, we have to deal with military matters, we have to deal with the election, we have to deal with politics. And when everything is in order and we have peace and security and a new government in our country, then we can get around to talking about this minor matter of women's rights. And it just doesn't work that way in any conflict, post-conflict country. That never works.
And the U.S. troops are part of the problem?
Well, the troops are part of the problem, but this is more, I think, a question of Afghan attitudes, that Afghans can talk, even the mullahs know how to talk about women's rights when they're talking to NGOs, so that they can get some assistance from the NGOs. But they don't for a minute believe that. And what we've seen with this law now is evidence that the government doesn't believe it either, that women's so-called rights can be taken away at any time. And in other post-conflict situations, what the UN has found after years of experience now in trying to affect conflict resolution and work out a new peaceable state, they have found that any peace negotiations that do not fully involve the women of the country at, in decision-making capacity at every level of negotiations wind up right back in conflict again afterwards. And they find that the final resolution, so-called resolution, doesn't really attend to the needs of the people, which are much better represented by women than by men, such things as education, health care, sanitation, and so on. So in 2000, the UN drew up Security Council Resolution 1325 that insists that women must be involved at every stage in order to attain what the UN calls durable peace, lasting peace. And in Afghanistan, that is, has not happened, and it's not going to happen as long as these attitudes that women's rights are some special category that we can deal with later persist.
Ann Jones is the author of Kabul in Winter. She's a photographer and a human rights activist. I also finally spoke with Samir Dosani, the Demand Dignity Campaign Director with Amnesty International United States.
What do you think Obama's goal in Afghanistan is, given his push for more troops? I mean, he's supposed to be the liberal alternative to George W. Bush. What do you think his point is?
You know, that's a really good question. And I think when we look at any U.S. leader, any leader all over the world, I mean, I think we have to look at what their stated goals are as opposed to what their actual goals may be, right? So the stated goal in Afghanistan is to end the Taliban insurgency, is to sort of capture more people, is to achieve some security and stability in Taliban through military, through military ends, right? So that's a stated goal. But if we look at what it would take to do that in a really meaningful sense, the troop involvement, even if though it's increased, is nowhere near enough to do that. I mean, look at how many, you know, just to give a random example, how many French people it took to you know, sort of occupy a really up-in-arms Algeria in the 1960s. I mean, it was very, very significant involvement of a colonial power in order to subdue a population militarily. And even that, you know, only lasted for a couple of years, and then they finally gave up. And then there's the question of the real ends. And the real ends, to me, are kind of unclear. I mean, I think Obama's real end is really just politics. I mean, I think he wants to appear to be not soft on terror. He wants to be able to wind down things in Iraq while at the same time not facing criticism from the right wing. And I think that's, if that's the real case, I think it's deeply cynical. I mean, I think, you know, we're talking about real people, real problems. I mean, I think we need real solutions. And we don't need to be placating people, oh, we'll do this from the left, if you like, to sort of withdraw some troops from Iraq, and even that's not ambitious enough, right? And then from the right, we'll ramp things up in Afghanistan. I think it largely is pure politics, and if that's the case, it's hard to judge motivation, obviously. But to the extent that that's the case, I think it's very disappointing.
What role do you think Afghan expats, Afghan Americans can and should play? This is a conference that attracted mostly Americans and Afghan Americans, but a lot of Afghan Americans were involved in backing the current central government and designing it, and seem to be fairly attached to the notion of a U.S. troop presence.
Yeah, it's complicated, isn't it? I mean, if we look, you know, just like all Afghans can't be put in the same category, not all Afghan Americans can be put in the same category, right? It's a diverse population with different needs and interests. Some of those are purely economic, right? So people who are looking at their home country as a place to do business, as a place to maybe do some subcontracting, some of whom, you know, are really, you know, maybe have connections to local groups that were oppressed in the 1980s when there were some movements that were coming up in the post sort of Cold War period, getting close to the post-Cold War period, shall we say. So, you know, I think we have to be a little bit strategic about this and say, you know, okay, given that there are all these diverse interests, what role can this diaspora play? And is it a constructive role or a destructive role? I mean, I'm more familiar with another diaspora, say the Iranian diaspora, which is really playing, I think, a destructive role. I mean, I'm a critique of, from the left, obviously, I'm a critique of the sort of fundamentalist Shia Irani regime. But I look at the criticisms that are coming from the Iranian expatriate community, and they're really just off the wall. I mean, they really are people who kind of want to go back to the Shah, and that's, you know, that's understandable because those are people who were exiled when the Shah lost power, right? So I think we have to say, okay, to what extent do the Afghani community represent those kind of interests, and to what extent do they represent what we would identify as more progressive, pro-people interests? And how can those elements of, from a more strategic point of view, if we're interested in sort of, making the world sort of conform with human rights standards and improving everyone's quality of life, how can the section of the Afghani expatriate community who would like to make things better and bring in human rights and so on in a meaningful way, how can we strengthen and empower those people? Well, that's really a question.
And finally, what do you think it's going to take to bring a greater awareness among the American population, the majority of which, at least some polls have shown, support the Obama push for more troops? It seems as though the U.S. occupation in Afghanistan is very similar to that in Iraq, but Americans view it quite differently.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate in this country that, even if we go back to Vietnam, it's hard to see movements against the war developing until there's a significant number of U.S. body bags coming back, of people, U.S. soldiers coming back dead. And I think that's really unfortunate. It's really short-sighted. I think we as an American, people, as the American people, have a kind of lack of compassion, a lack of solidarity. We don't see things from the other's point of view. We see things more in the rah-rah, and we believe the propaganda. I mean, let me just say, with the internet out there and with other forms of media, with your great station and other good progressive media, that's changing a little bit. I think you're right to say that it's supported by much of the U.S. population, but the extent to which the population doesn't support it, so maybe it's 20-30%, and even if we go back to the wars of my childhood, Gulf War I, I mean, there were not 20% of the population speaking out against that, right, or who were not in agreement with that, right? So things are changing. Maybe they're changing slower than a lot of us would like to see, but I think that we have to sort of maintain some hope, and we have to try and do that education work so that in the long run we can actually build in a sense of international solidarity, we can build in a sense of international justice in our own psyche that I think is missing. I really think that if we look at American history, if we look at the history of conquest and colonialism and so on, and I just think that empathy gene is sort of missing. We don't see things from the point of view of the person who's getting oppressed. We just, see the flag waving and the sloganeering, and that's all we sort of see.
Samir Dosani, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sanam.
Samir Dosani is the Demand Dignity Campaign Director of Amnesty International. I also spoke with Anne Jones, human rights activist and author of Kabul in Winter, and Christian Parenti, correspondent for The Nation magazine. And that was part of a report back from the Afghanistan Peace and Development Conference in Queens, New York last week. In just a few minutes after this week's Empire Notes, we'll be joined in studio by an Afghanistan vet, Rick Reyes. He wants Americans to rethink our strategy in Afghanistan. We'll also, after today's Subversive Historian, find out about the story of how four white teens were acquitted of most charges in the fatal beating of a Mexican immigrant in a Pennsylvania city. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with this week's Empire Notes. Empire Notes are weekly commentaries filed by Rahul Mahajan, author of Full Spectrum Dominance and The New Crusade. Today's commentary is on the surge in violence in Iraq.
While our attention is relentlessly focused elsewhere, Iraq has temporarily regained its position as the suicide bombing capital of the world. Apparently, it's not quite the bastion of peace, freedom, and light we might have thought. In April, over 300 people, almost all Shia, were killed in sensational mass casualty suicide bombings, including over 160 in one two-day stretch reminiscent of 2005 or 2006. Hillary Clinton's immediate statement that these bombings didn't mean anything, that they were a sign that al-Qaeda in Iraq is weak and on the run, is a textbook example of the stopped watch that sometimes tells the correct time. Identical to every Bush administration statement every time anything happened in Iraq, statements like hers carry no information content whatsoever. I think, however, in this case, she's right. These attacks do not signal a significant resurgence of Sunni militant activity in Iraq or a full-scale shattering of the tenuous calm that has gripped the country. In part, they may be a response to the Iraqi government's recent announcement that they captured AQI's supposed chief of operations, who goes by the nom de guerre Abu Omar al-Baghdadi. They're also enabled in part by the fact that the Iraqi government has been going after some of their natural predators. The Mahdi army has been essentially disbanded, except supposedly for a hardcore of fighters around Sadr. More interesting, the Sahwa, the formerly 100,000-strong force of tribal Sunnis and ex-insurgents assembled by the United States to destroy the insurgency, is in trouble. In Anbar, they won the January elections and have formed the provincial government, but in general, they have not fared well. They've been essentially abandoned by their American sponsors to the tender mercies of the Shia-dominated government. Promises to integrate a significant portion of them into the Iraqi army have gone largely unimplemented. In an important recent article about them, Nir Rosen concludes that the Sunnis have lost the civil war and that the Sahwa has no chance of rekindling it. He also hints that from the beginning, the Americans intended to let their allies be imprisoned once the job at hand, destruction of the insurgency, was done. This is not surprising in a certain sense. The United States has a very poor record of standing by the various tools that it uses, not least in Iraq. In another sense, it ought to be. For years, I have noted with surprise the almost total lack of any coherent planning by the United States in Iraq to serve any interests at all, beyond the narrow one of defeating whichever enemies happen to be shooting at its forces. And with considerably less surprise, the inability of much of the left to alter its consistent analysis of overarching, carefully constructed American plans for geopolitical domination. An elementary lesson in the calculus of power. The Sahwa was more than a way to destroy the insurgency, it was a significant political foothold for the United States. Given the overwhelming political weakness of the U.S. position in Iraq, the logical thing to do would have been to hang on to it, keep it a coherent force, continue to pay its monthly salaries from U.S. coffers. Instead, for over a year now, the United States has been lowballing them, trying to get the Iraqi government to pay for them, trying to get some integrated into the Iraqi army, and rather explicitly talking about turning most of them into garbage collectors. If political domination of, or at least strong political influence over, Iraq was one of the key goals in the invasion, why would you throw away such a valuable asset as the United States has done? In truth, for some years now, U.S. policymakers have been unable to articulate coherent interests in Iraq, beyond the obvious and reflexive one of not being beaten and leaving the field completely open to forces that are not well disposed to us. This fact is also in part why there's no talk about altering the withdrawal schedule despite the violence. The other reason, of course, is Afghanistan, which says the chairman of the Joint Chiefs has, quote, been an economy of force operation for far too long. It's precisely when conception of interests are in such flux that new ways of thinking can most easily be introduced. So far, the only new way of thinking on foreign policy that has gotten a wide hearing has been to go back to pre-Bush business as usual. But the door is still not closed, and there is an opening for other thoughts. For Empire Notes, this is Rahul Mahajan.
Visit www.empirenotes.org for more information. Twenty-nine-year-old Rick Reyes was born to immigrants from Mexico and grew up in Boyle Heights. He joined the Marine Corps and served in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, based on his experience in Afghanistan and given President Obama's promised troop surge, he thinks the U.S. should, at minimum, rethink the Afghanistan war. In April, Reyes testified to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee alongside other veterans of the Afghan war. This is some of what he had to say.
In some respects, this entire occupation has become counterproductive. As a Marine, I was willing to give my life for my country and still am, but invading and occupying Afghanistan, sending more troops to solve what is a political problem, is not the answer. I urge these senators to rethink Afghanistan while there is still time. I can almost guarantee that sending more troops will mean more civilian and U.S. troop casualties, not for war, but for occupation. Sending more troops will not make the U.S. safer. It will only build more opposition against us. I urge you on behalf of truth and patriotism to consider carefully and rethink Afghanistan. More troops, more occupation is not the answer.
Rick Reyes testifying in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He now joins me in studio. Welcome to Uprising, Rick.
Hello. Thank you for having me here.
So why did you say what you said at the committee hearing, that the occupation is not going well, that you think at minimum we need to rethink our strategy in Afghanistan?
The reason I made that statement was because of through my experience on the ground in both Afghanistan and Iraq, I was able to see that the strategy wasn't working and the objective wasn't being met.
Give us some more details. What do you mean by that? And in fact, what is the objective of the United States?
Well, our objective there was to locate and detain suspected Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
And that's it. I mean, what about the sort of larger goal of security in Afghanistan and women's rights, human rights in general? Was that a stated goal, or was that just expected to be the side outcome, perhaps?
Well, as a ground troop and the infantry, our main objective was to locate terrorists.
How did you do that? Like, how? What was the conduct on the ground, day-to-day operations of U.S. troops?
We patrolled through neighborhoods, That's
just in villages and cities.
Yeah, exactly. We just would patrol through these neighborhoods with a translator that was a translator that somehow, I'm not sure where the translator came, but from the extent of my knowledge, it was just someone in the general population in these countries. And the way these translators would come about was we would offer them an incentive for the amount of information that they were able to provide. So based on that, it seemed like most of the time we were just on a wild goose chase.
Because the intelligence you were getting was based on being able to get some income for the translator, but not necessarily be accurate?
Yeah, they were just being – they were offered incentives by providing intelligence, and that there was no way to prove if that intelligence was correct or not.
And what did you do with the intelligence? Like, what did you do when somebody told you that there was a suspected Al-Qaeda or Taliban person living in this house?
We'd patrol the area first just to get an idea of what the terrain or just to get an idea of the general area. Once we were able to – once we felt comfortable enough with the area, we'd plan raids or attacks on these suspected points of interest.
What was a raid like?
There were usually night raids. We'd go in there mostly when people were probably asleep. And we'd just raid the home from all directions and arrest and detain whoever was in there.
And what was the effect of such a raid? And did you often get the wrong person?
It didn't work. Every time we detained someone, at the end of it all, we just let them go.
So they were mostly innocent?
They were mostly innocent, and whatever we did destroy along the way, we tried to compensate the destruction with offering food or money or, you know, replacing doors or windows, whatever it was. So just the entire operation was just counterproductive from beginning to end.
So in your entire time that you served, did you ever apprehend an honest-to-goodness member of the Taliban or Al-Qaeda?
From my experience, no.
So what was then the result of these actions, these on-the-ground actions? How did, I mean, did people accept the compensation of food and the replacement of doors and windows graciously, or?
No, they were very angry. The population was just very angry at us. They didn't want us there. They wouldn't, whenever we'd enter into a neighborhood for the first time, we were never greeted humbly. We'd have young kids as young as 5, 6, 7 years old running at us, throwing rocks, giving us the finger, who knows where. They learned that, but that's what they do.
You served also in Iraq. How similar are operations in Afghanistan and Iraq?
Very similar. Very similar. Almost identical. The only differences are maybe some of the terrain, but overall it's the same strategy.
I'm speaking with Rick Reyes. He is from Los Angeles, served in both Iraq and Afghanistan. He testified at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee very recently about the strategy, U.S. strategy in Afghanistan. This is happening the day we're having this interview the day before President Obama meets with the presidents of Pakistan and Afghanistan tomorrow in a high-level summit. So let's talk about the president's strategy in terms of adding more troops. I'm not sure that the president has discussed changing the on-the-ground strategy of these new troops or even the existing troops. So adding more troops, it seems as though, will just make the problem bigger.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest elephant in the room that Washington doesn't want to admit to is the problem with the strategy being implemented with the escalation in troops. It's the same strategy. It didn't work before. It's not going to work today, especially now that the approval rating by the Afghanistan population has decreased dramatically.
And the approval rating has decreased predictably because of the actions you were just describing.
Yes, by the strategies implemented by the ground troops.
Are the Taliban becoming more popular now as a result of the U.S. actions?
I it's hard to say if they're becoming more popular. I know that they offer an incentive to side with the Taliban. Versus what we're doing is we're giving them a motive to oppose us with the combination of the incentive from the Taliban, they side
And the Taliban are very openly saying that they want to drive the Americans out, so they become a more attractive force to join.
When I was after the congressional hearings in front of the Foreign Relations Committee, I met with some of the members of Congress, and one thing that they mentioned was that the Taliban have a great business model. They have a tremendous, just a very flawless business model that Washington is having a very difficult time countering that business model. So they know there's a problem.
And is that basically that the Taliban has a secure source of funding and they offer social services to the people?
Exactly, yes.
Let's talk about that source of funding. The drug policy in Afghanistan of the United States has not been clear as far as I can tell. You were among the earliest troops to enter Afghanistan. What was the U.S.'s drug policy when the war first started? I know currently there's a push for troops to actually take part in drug eradication efforts, but that wasn't the case in 2001, 2002, was it?
Most of the times these fields are just being mowed down. Mowed down and destroyed. So.
And did that happen even early on?
I don't know if it happened earlier than that, but during that time these fields were just being destroyed, which just leads to another motive for the Afghanistan people to oppose us.
So, and who controls the poppy fields? I'm not sure if you can tell, just, you know, serving there. There are also drug lords who are serving in parliament, but then there are ordinary people who are benefiting from the drug sales because people are so poor there, so drugs are lucrative, but then the drugs are also funding the Taliban.
Yes, they are. Through what I've been able to research is that in the late 60s, early 70s, Turkey was a mirror image of what Afghanistan is today.
Turkey.
It had a very deteriorated government, a huge drug problem. And what the policies that were placed in Turkey was to turn these, to legalize these poppy fields for pharmaceutical purposes. If you look at Turkey today, it's a member of NATO. You would never imagine it was very similar to Afghanistan, of what Afghanistan is today. So we need to really look at those different strategies, and that's just proof that going about it that way will work.
Rick, when the military announces that we've killed, you know, X number of insurgents, quote unquote, in a particular area of Afghanistan, what does that mean? Just from your personal experience being there, can the military tell the difference between who's an insurgent and who's just a civilian?
I couldn't tell the difference, and I was there with them within just arm's distance, and I couldn't tell.
So it's likely that the casualties of civilians is a big understatement?
I think the success rate is very low. It's extremely low, to the point where it just doesn't make any sense. There is no effective way to tell the Taliban apart from the general population.
So it's just getting a sense of what you've been saying in this interview, what you said in your testimony. It seems as though the U.S. went in there. I mean, we've been there 7.5 years now in Afghanistan. We went in there with objectives that were fairly narrow, but with tactics that didn't seem to work, that made things only worse. And the president wants to now add more troops, which is not necessarily going to improve the problem. It's only going to make things worse. What should U.S. troops be doing in Afghanistan, you think, if anything?
Right now they're also conducting humanitarian aid missions, but the line between humanitarian aid and combat operations is very thin.
And that's not a good thing.
And very blended, it's also another reason why a lot of the humanitarian aid right now being implemented by the U.N. are being attacked. Because they're
So basically people are associating the UN aid with military operations because the American and NATO soldiers are carrying out humanitarian aid work while also carrying out military operations.
Yes.
Yeah. Tell us about these provincial reconstruction teams, as they're called, the PRTs, that the U.S. and NATO operate. So basically it's like groups of soldiers that go out and try to get some goodwill in a village by building a well or building a school.
Through my experience, it just goes back to offering incentives for intelligence, which is basically the same way these groups are operating. They're they're offering aid
as a tool, in a way,
as a tool to receive more information on where suspected Taliban or Al-Qaeda forces might be.
So, and for anybody who is part of a non-governmental humanitarian organization, this is like the biggest no-no that you do in a battlefield. To use aid as a political tool to get information is sort of violating a lot of human rights ethics. But so you're saying that that's happening regularly. Rick, I want to turn now to your own personal background. You served as a Marine. You're from East L.A. You grew up in Boyle Heights. What made you join the Marines? And did you think you would sort of be where you are today? Did you think you were going to be fighting in two wars and then sort of looking, you know, you're a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War, so you're against the Iraq War, you're questioning the Afghanistan War. Did you imagine that you'd be in this position?
No, of course not. I grew up in Boyle Heights, like you mentioned, and just coming from a rough neighborhood, there wasn't much direction, not much guidance. After-school resources were scarce or non-existent. So as I got older, I decided to just take responsibility for my own life, and I thought joining the Marine Corps would be the best thing to do.
Hmm. And what about your background has influenced what you've seen in the Afghanistan war? As part of your testimony to the Senate, you said patrols to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, you said patrols were conducted through populated neighborhoods. The populations on those neighborhood streets weren't any different from the population on my street.
Well, on my street, I see mothers, I see fathers, I see kids playing, running around the streets. Just a regular neighborhood. And during these patrols in these foreign countries, those neighborhoods were very identical to mine. You'd see children playing, fathers coming home from work, mothers chasing behind those kids, and it was like a patrol through my neighborhood. And when we take the fight to their front door, it didn't seem right.
You're a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War, as I mentioned, so you're against the Iraq War. Do you think that the U.S. should withdraw forces from Afghanistan and end that war too?
That's a very difficult question to answer. What I do know is that escalating the troops is, it's not the most effective way of winning Afghanistan.
And IBAW has not taken a position on Afghanistan yet?
Not yet, but we're getting more involved, getting more educated, and just looking at the current policies that are being implemented in Afghanistan, and then we connect the similarities between Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's almost one and the same.
Hmm. And how common is your sentiment, your questioning of the Afghanistan war among veterans and also troops currently serving in Afghanistan, you think?
You know, it's funny because when I delivered my statement in front of the Foreign Relations Committee, after all was said and done, one of the other panelists came, I'm not going to say which one, but they came to me to thank me for delivering my statement and admitted that they all feel the same way, but for some reason no one wants to say anything about it. I've been able to talk to some of the guys I served with, and at first they were, they just didn't agree with my outlook, but after they gave it some thought and started to realize what was happening, now I have their full support. So amongst veterans, I think the sentiment's very common, but just that they're, most aren't coming out and saying anything.
I want to thank the folks at Brave New Foundation, Robert Greenwald's organization, for helping us bring you to Uprising today. You found Robert Greenwald, who's doing a series of short documentary films called Rethink Afghanistan Online. You found him through Facebook. Was this your first sort of reaching out to speak out about the Afghanistan war? As you've said, not too many people are willing to sort of speak out against our policies there. And did this sort of meeting, if you will, give you the confidence to say that?
I found him on Facebook. Like you mentioned, I sent him a message just saying, keep up the good work. You're doing very necessary work. And then I didn't expect anything after that, but he replied and asked me a few questions. So I answered his questions, and I just gave him, you know, gave him some of my experience, and then from there I got involved with the Rethink Afghanistan campaign. We pushed a petition for the congressional hearings. I just never imagined I'd be the one to deliver a statement at the congressional hearings.
And perhaps other troops, other veterans now may, seeing your testimony, change their minds about speaking out. Rick, where can listeners find out more? Can you give the website for Rethink Afghanistan?
Yes, it's www.rethinkafghanistan.com. And there's also www.getafghanistanright.com.
That's rethinkafghanistan.com and getafghanistanright.com. Rick Reyes, I want to thank you very much for spending the time in studio and sharing your experience and insight with us.
Thank you for having me.
Rick Reyes, a former corporal in Afghanistan, one of the first to enter Afghanistan as part of Operation Enduring Freedom. He also served in Iraq, and he's a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. And you can find out more about his work and the work of Robert Greenwald on Afghanistan at rethinkafghanistan.com. We'll also link to his Senate Foreign Relations Committee testimony on our website later today at kpfk.org/uprising. You are listening to Uprising, and after today's Subversive Historian, we'll take a look at the recent acquittal of most of the charges against four white teens in a fatal beating of a Mexican immigrant in Pennsylvania. Stay tuned.
Hello, I'm Terry McNally. People are swamped. Too much content, not enough context. On Free Forum, Tuesdays at noon, it's my job to seek out, sort through, and bring back what matters. I talk to people with pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, even spirit, based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. That's Free Forum, Tuesdays at noon on KPFK 90.7 FM, streaming at kpfk.org.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Back in the day on May 5th, 1886, the Bayview tragedy took place in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Coming the very next day after the Haymarket tragedy in Chicago, seven marching workers were killed by the Wisconsin National Guard in the struggle for the right for an 8-hour workday. In the days leading up to the violent incident, workers had been organizing a series of protests. The German and Polish communities held a parade for the 8-hour workday on May 2nd that was followed up the very next day by brewery and building trade workers going out on strike. Defying the mayor's banning of public demonstrations, a group of about 1,500 workers marched to the Bayview Rolling Mill on May 5th when they were met by the National Guard. When Wisconsin Governor Jeremiah Rusk gave shoot-to-kill orders, the guardsmen opened fire. As People's historian Howard Zinn has noted, no one was ever held to account for the slayings. 50 striking workers, however, were sentenced to up to 9 months of hard labor. For Uprising, this is your truth professor, saying it's no mystery why they conceal our people's history.
You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. On the night of July 12, 2008, four white teenagers in Shenandoah, Pennsylvania, were involved in the fatal beating of a 25-year-old Mexican immigrant named Luis Ramirez. Last week, an all-white jury acquitted two of the teenagers, 19-year-old Derek Donchak and 17-year-old Brandon Pikarski, of aggravated assault, reckless endangerment, and ethnic intimidation for Ramirez's death. The only charge left was simple assault, to which the family and friends of the defendants loudly cheered and celebrated in the courtroom. That the teenagers were consuming alcohol and involved in the altercation last July was never disputed by the defendants' lawyers. But the picture painted was one of Luis Ramirez as the aggressor, who made, quote, some bad choices. Prosecutors, on the other hand, asserted that in fact the four young men baited Ramirez into a fight using racial slurs and brutally beat him, leaving him lying on the ground convulsing, foaming at the mouth, with his brain oozing out of his skull. Ramirez died of blunt force injuries in a hospital 2 days later, leaving behind his wife, who is a lifelong resident of Shenandoah, and his young children. The incident has highlighted a growing resentment against immigrant communities in Shenandoah and other similar towns. Eric Macklin, the jury foreman at the trial, revealed to the press that he had the most doubts among the jurors over the acquittals and was quoted as saying, "I do believe that all four boys involved are racists." Joining me on the line this morning is Gladys Limon. She is with the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund. She just returned from Pennsylvania yesterday. She was there for the entire trial. Welcome to Uprising, Gladys.
Hello. Thank you very much.
So first, let's talk about what actually you think happened and why you think these charges were dropped. Was it basically a lack of evidence as opposed to innocence?
Well, there are a lot of questions here as to why it is that the jury determinations completely absolved these defendants of all responsibility for their actions in brutally and fatally beating Luis Ramirez. You know, I think they're not only did they conduct themselves based out of, you know, racial hatred, or they're motivated based on Luis's national origin, but I think there are a lot of questions as well as to the prejudice that was intertwined in all of the proceedings, you know, from the very beginning through the end, including the jury's deliberations. As you mentioned, the jury foreman made public statements that suggest that even the jury's deliberations were tainted with racism.
Hmm. So was it in doubt that the boys used racial slurs, or was that accepted?
There was overwhelming evidence that established that this was a hate crime, as well as, you know, all the other charges. The ethnic intimidation, which is a hate crime charge in Pennsylvania, as well as the homicide charges, were obviously the hardest to prove. And I had actually prepared myself mentally for the jury to come back with a not guilty verdict on those charges. However, what's very telling and completely reveals how questionable this entire process was, and then questions the integrity of the jury's deliberations, are the fact that they also returned not guilty verdicts on the lesser charges, including aggravated assault, recklessly endangering another person, and also criminal solicitation, which was a charge against Pekarsky, who is alleged to have been the kicker. I mean,
the person who delivered the fatal kick, the final
exactly,
fatal kick.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. As to these lesser charges, it's really hard to understand how any juror could have had reasonable doubt that they were guilty as to these lesser crimes.
So basically, these were four boys involved, and the person that they were targeting died of the beating, but the only charge that the jury decided to make was simple assault. What does simple assault usually mean?
Well, simple assault is very minor, obviously. I mean, simple assault is, you know, pushing somebody.
So you're walking on the street and you decide to push somebody. Nothing necessarily happens to them, but they can then, you know, take me to court and I could be convicted of simple assault. That's basically it.
You know, it's some sort of bodily injury, right? But the aggravated assault is attempting to or actually causing serious bodily injury or death. And the actual definition is, you know, attempting to or actually causing serious bodily injury or death in either intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly. And recklessly means manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life. And here there was overwhelming evidence that this beating was brutal in every sense. You know, these were initially six big, strong football players who encountered Luis Ramirez. You know, one of the witnesses himself said, you know, I wasn't scared of him. He was smaller than us. We were six against one. So it's completely this argument that the defense attorneys presented that these guys were defending themselves is just completely ridiculous.
The other characterization was that the teenagers were kids or adolescents, whereas Ramirez was an adult, even though he was 25. The oldest among the white boys was 19, so only a six-year age difference. And the defense attorney said that Ramirez made some bad choices, as though he sort of chose to get into this fight?
I mean, this was their characterization. This was their strategy, and obviously it was effective with the jury. And this was all about humanizing and creating sympathy for these quote-unquote boys and demonizing Luis Ramirez. Luis Ramirez was 25. He was by himself. Again, these six guys were football players. They were not kids by any means. They did not engage in kid-like behavior that night. They engaged in very adult-like behavior and made some egregious choices. You know, they had been drinking the afternoon. They had been at a block party where Pekarsky, the alleged kicker, had actually instigated an altercation with the town official, with the firefighter, and they had been kicked out of that block party, and they were already sort of like in the state of mind when they encountered Luis. This was, again, just part of the strategy of, you know, they kept referring to them as boys and kids. And surprisingly, the prosecution recharacterized and referred to them in that sense as well, which was, I think, outrageous. And Luis was just referred to as the deceased, you know, as Mr. Ramirez. And the judge in this case let in some evidence that the defense effectively used to, again, really, you know, criminalize and demonize Luis Ramirez, which was completely irrelevant to the acts, the egregious acts that were committed against him. You know, and I think that the defense attorneys very effectively appeal to the jurors' own biases and prejudices.
My guest is Gladys Limon. She is with the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund. Now, you talked about some of the things that the prosecutor did. Were there character witnesses that were allowed in? Were there other witnesses to the incident itself that were allowed to testify?
There were three of the witnesses were there that night. Two who engaged and participated in the beating. There were five total, and another two who had not engaged. There were two guys who also encountered Luis Ramirez that night, but they made the decision to not participate, to not beat on Luis Ramirez. They just stood back, and they testified as to what they saw. The other two who did engage in the beating, one is Colin Walsh, and he pled guilty in federal court. He is a guy who punched Luis Ramirez and knocked him to the ground, causing the injury to the back of his head. And the other guy, he is being charged as a juvenile. He's a person who, you know, took the stand and admitted to yelling racial epithets to Luis Ramirez when they first encountered him, and pretty much throughout the entire time, yelling things such as, you know, get the F out of Shenandoah, you effing Mexican.
Let's talk about the reaction in the community, not only in Shenandoah, but in Pennsylvania and across the country. How have people reacted to this acquittal of most of the charge, every charge except simple assault of these two teenagers involved?
I think people generally are shocked. The Latino community definitely is shocked and very, very fearful about the precedent that this sets. They live in a very small town. It's a small community, and they feel that they are now vulnerable to being similarly attacked without any sort of protection. They have very, very little law enforcement there. They don't trust the police department. So they are very fearful and, feel very alone. The larger community as well is, I think, sort of split, but I think one thing that is heartening is that a lot of white members of the community have expressed a similar shock and disgust as to the verdict. Before you had a lot of white members of the community who sort of, you know, either stayed silent on the issue or, you know, sort of sided on the side of the defendants. And I think that the verdict is so glaringly unjust that at this point, you know, they have to come to terms with it and realize that, you know, this is just a complete failure of justice, that these guys completely got away with murder without suffering any consequences whatsoever. So I think it's really hit folks in that way, and I know that there's a lot of support as well throughout the entire country and concern about what this says. You know, I think everybody has that. At one point or another, asked himself the question of what would have happened if this was the other way around. You know, if six Latinos in Shenandoah would have encountered, you know, a white guy, a white man that night, and they would have beat him and killed him. There's no doubt in my mind that, one, they would have been arrested right away. They would not have been out on probation as these defendants have, and they would have been found guilty and they would have been imprisoned.
That sounds very likely. Gladys, what is MALDEF, your organization, planning to do? Is there any way to appeal this, take it to a higher, maybe a federal court?
Yeah, so one, we're going to continue to work with the local community and support them, as well as the Ramirez family. And we are going to continue to urge the Department of Justice to continue to investigate and also file federal charges against these defendants to seek to vindicate the death of Luis Ramirez, as well as the larger national interests.
Also, in terms of locally, are there any sort of demonstrations that took place after the acquittal? Are there other actions that are being planned?
This is a very important question. One, because again, the Latino community in this area is very small. The community generally is very small, and they don't feel that some sort of demonstration would be productive. I had a phone conference call yesterday with community leaders and have continued to work with them throughout this entire process. you know, and I know that there are a lot of people from the outside who obviously, just like me, are very outraged and want to do something, and part of that something is going into Shenandoah and having rallies or marches or some sort of demonstration. And the local Latino community is very apprehensive about that because, again, they have no law enforcement protection. So what happens when you have groups, you know, come in with the intention of supporting the local community and asking for justice, they leave. You know, I get to come back to Los Angeles. They get to go back to New York or Chicago or wherever they came from. But they leave the local Latino community alone to deal with those consequences.
Mm. So, finally, Gladys, where's is there a website for MALDEF that people can find out more information?
Yes, it's MALDEF.org.
That's MALDEF.org. Gladys, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Gladys Limon is with the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, or MALDEF. That's at MALDEF.org. For Sonali Subversive Thought Fedre, Judge Sturgis once said, "Justice is open to everyone in the same way as the Ritz Hotel." That's Sonali Subversive Thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. To get a CD of today's program, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or online at pacificaradioarchives.org. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Stephanie Rivera is our intern. And Nadia Richardson is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of this program after 10 a.m. today on our website at kpfk.org/uprising. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kulhatkar. Thanks so much for listening, and see you tomorrow at 8.